From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on tensions in Iraq. A mix of sadness and anger after a military strike in eastern Ukraine. New South African law worrying immigrants from Zimbabwe. Plus World Cup scores and honoring one of the sports greats. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's security spokesperson, Lieutenant General Qasem Atta, says Iraqi forces have regained the initiative, in his words, in their fight against Sunni militants who have sieged large parts of the country and vow to overrun the capital, Baghdad. Edward Uranian reporting now from the VOA Middle East Bureau. Not everyone agrees on the state of the militants' insurgency.
Eyewitness reports and information on rival television networks are contradictory. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki lashed out at media organizations Friday for allegedly distorting the truth. The government cut internet connections Sunday in another sign of nervousness. Iraqi intelligence chief General Qasem Mohammed Atta said Sunday the situation in the capital, Baghdad, was secure and government forces were pushing back the militants from the al-Qaeda-linked Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. He says that the situation differs from that of one or two days ago, and the government armed forces have gained traction. He says the situation in Baghdad is completely under control, and security checkpoints are in place in various areas to defend against attack. Eyewitness reports say cement roadblocks have been erected in front of key government installations, including the governmental nerve center in Baghdad's Green Zone. Volunteers were reported to be digging trenches in the north of the capital. Arab TV channels reported a car bomb killed more than a dozen people in the center of Baghdad. Heavy fighting and government air raids were also reported over the town of Tal Afar near Mosul, and General Atta said Iraqi forces pushed back ISIL militants near the town of Balad, north of Baghdad. Al Arabiya TV reported government planes bombed a Kurdish Peshmerga convoy near the oil-rich city of Kirkuk, now under Kurdish control. The report said more than a dozen Peshmerga fighters were killed or wounded. Other reports indicated the Peshmerga had captured the Yarubiya border post between Iraq and Syria on the road to Mosul.
كثير ممن يحملون السلاح في داخل مدينة الموصل هم ليسوا إرهابيين.
The governor of Mosul, Athil Nujafi, complained that government warplanes were bombing civilian targets inside the city, now occupied by Sunni militants. He went on to argue the forces controlling the city belong to different Sunni factions and not just to ISIL. Sharqiya TV showed long lines of hundreds of vehicles, which it claimed continue to flee Mosul. Sunni militants also reportedly blew up two churches inside the city, and many, if not all, remaining Christian residents of the city have reportedly fled. While thousands of Shiite volunteers turned out in government-held areas to join the Iraqi military, some reports say many Sunnis were reportedly joining the militants and their allies. In Cairo, Arab League deputy head Ahmed Ben Heli told a news conference the group's ministerial council is supporting the Iraqi government's effort to defeat the terrorists.
أيضا أكد المجلس دعم العراق في مواجهة الأعمال الإرهابية.
But he urged the country's fractious leaders to overcome their political and religious differences and to form a united government. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
For some perspective on the state of al-Qaeda and its affiliates, such as the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, and Nigeria's Boko Haram, VOA's Carol Castiel and Henrik Fente spoke with Catherine Zimmerman, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Here's Carol Castiel.
Catherine, I'd like to get your take on the status of al-Qaeda as you see it today, if you agree with President Obama that Al-Qaeda core or the Al-Qaeda central, as we know it, has been severely degraded and that what is of more concern are its affiliates around the world.
Obama's message that Al-Qaeda central has been degraded rings true, but the problem is that he's presenting the rest of Al-Qaeda as decentralized and weaker. The fact is, during the Arab Spring, over the course of 2011, all of these affiliates in Yemen, in Somalia, in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere developed relationships that actually extend across the Muslim-majority world. And it's these relationships that have made the network itself stronger. They are much more resilient in terms of attacks, and they share resources like expertise, building bombs, foreign fighters, money. All of this can be utilized in an attack against the United States or our interests in the region, as we've seen. And this is one of the reasons why I am very concerned about the dismissal of the threat from Al-Qaeda. It's still very strong today. And just because we've hammered it in Afghanistan and Pakistan doesn't mean that the threat has disappeared.
Well, to his credit, or to be fair to President Obama, he did say that the threat is still significant, but it requires a sort of a shift in our strategy. And he wants to partner with other countries, I guess, like in Mali, the French, in Yemen, the Yemeni security forces. What about this shift to work with our partners? Do you think that will be effective?
I'm very hesitant in saying that it will be. It's actually not a shift in strategy because we've been partnering with the Yemeni military, the African Union peacekeeping forces in Somalia, the Mali army, and other African forces in Mali. That hasn't pushed the groups back. What is new is the dedication of a budget, essentially, for this counterterrorism force. And Obama has twisted it in some degree and presented the entire strategy as being new. When you look at the efficacy of our partners, it's very mixed. And in some cases, like in Nigeria, it's been counterproductive.
Counterproductive in Nigeria?
What has happened over the past 3 years is that the terrorist group Boko Haram has actually moved from being a smaller terrorist group and simply a nuisance to an active insurgency. And the threat it poses today to the Nigerian state and its reach, Boko Haram's reach, is much greater than it was 3 years ago because of the activities pursued by the Nigerian military.
Indeed. Well, that's a very good point, which we want to pursue in a bit. But let me Henok Fente ask a question first.
Now, let me ask you, Catherine. The president crystallized the new strategy. And of course, this strategy has been being implemented in Africa for a number of years. The United States partners with the government of Somalia, the African Union forces, as you mentioned earlier, as well as with the government of Nigeria. This begs the question, without putting boots on the ground, I'm talking about U.S. military on the ground, this kind of partnerships in the short term and then the long-term effectiveness of this kind of strategies, if you could talk about that, because in the short term, yes, there needs to be security cooperations, but in the long term also, making sure that these countries are stable, that the governance thrives in these countries is an issue.
I think that's a very fair point where a lot of our counterterrorism strategy today is looking at the short-term effect. We use drone strikes to interdict and disrupt ongoing plots, and we rely on our partners in various countries to actually try to roll back the territorial gains. But what we haven't done is undertaken a strategy that actually looks at the long term, the governance issues in many of these areas, and the grievances that actually are driving the conflict. And it's these grievances that allow Al-Qaeda groups to gain popular support and actually exploit populations to their advantage. So that's where I think that this counterterrorism strategy actually falls a little bit short, where we're relying simply on military partners to produce a military defeat against a terrorist group. In many of these cases, it's not terrorism, it's an insurgency. That's an entirely different effort from the United States, and it's one that I'm not seeing.
Catherine Zimmerman is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She spoke with VOA's Carol Castiel, host of the program Press Conference USA, and Henok Fente of the VOA Horn of Africa service. You can hear more of their conversation by going to voanews.com and look for Press Conference USA under the program tab. Still ahead, after 2 months, many of the kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls are still missing.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
2 months ago, in mid-April, more than 200 girls were kidnapped from their schoolhouse in northeastern Nigeria. Since then, protests nationwide and around the world have demanded their return, and countries around the globe have offered their help. But the girls remain missing. Heather Murdoch reports now from Abuja that analysts say the time for ordinary solutions is over.
The girls were snatched from a remote town in northeastern Nigeria on April 14th, and families are devastated. More than 50 girls escaped by jumping out of vehicles and running through the bush, but most remain missing. Amina was one of those who fled before militants could reach their hiding spot. She says men in uniform came to their school dorms around 11 at night. Initially, the girls thought the men were soldiers there to protect them from Boko Haram, the Islamist militant group that has killed thousands of people, including hundreds of children in their schools. When the men set their school on fire, Amina and other girls knew they were not soldiers.
What do we want?
Results. 2 weeks after the kidnapping, mothers of the kidnapped girls organized a march on the capital, and activists from across Nigeria and around the world mobilized, demanding the rescue of the girls. Amid the international attention, Boko Haram released a video that shows about 100 girls in the bush, and local leaders confirmed they were the kidnapped victims.
Wallah.
In it, Abu Bakr Shekau, who claims to lead the group, threatens to sell the girls as wives and kidnap more women if imprisoned Boko Haram members are not released. Some Nigerian officials have said they will not negotiate with the terrorist group, fearing it will encourage more kidnappings. But University of Abuja Criminology and Social Sciences professor Femi Odikunle agrees with some analysts who say the girls will never be freed unless the government agrees to swap them for prisoners.
I believe that the government should go out of his way to make deals with the Boko Haram people or their representatives to get the girls released, because after all, if the girls are released, you could still go ahead and pursue. But militarily, if you try to attack them, you are likely to kill, to get the girls killed. You won't get the Boko Haram, you won't get your girls.
If the girls are rescued or released, analysts say they are likely to go home traumatized, potentially victims of sexual violence. At a daily vigil in the Nigerian capital, Hadiza Bala Usman, one of the organizers of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, says there is no doubt that the girls have already suffered trauma.
Being held by terrorists is a traumatic experience. So indeed, the girls would be traumatized. To the extent that you're held against your will, you're held by terrorists, you're snatched away from your school, you were snatched away at gunpoint.
Protesters say their rallies are met with increasing distrust from the government, and after 2 months, neither Boko Haram nor Nigerian security forces have given any indication that the girls are any closer to coming home. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
And two U.S. lawmakers were in Nigeria over the weekend. They reiterated Washington's plans to take action in combating the militant group Boko Haram, but wouldn't specify details. Congressman Steve Stockman spoke to reporters in Abuja.
Pending approval of the government of Nigeria and our government, we plan to take action, but I don't think we can go in specifics at this time because I think it was classified briefing. So we stand ready to help. And as long as our government and Nigeria government approves, we'll take action.
Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee is one of the other delegates from the United States.
We stand with the message to bring the girls back. But we also saw the pain and the suffering of so many victims. And there were thousands that we have not been able to see. We know that Boko Haram still has these girls, but we also know that they are still going into places of worship, no matter what the religion, and killing people, and taking girls and kidnapping others.
The visit by the U.S. delegation came as the Nigerian military says it's considering the Sri Lankan model it used to defeat Tamil separatists in its war against Boko Haram. military has come under rising criticism from Nigerians who say they do not feel protected by the security forces and that they are forced to fend off attacks by Boko Haram on their own. Unidentified gunmen opened fire on a popular Indian Ocean coastal town that's in Kenya Sunday in an attack that witnesses say went on for hours. There's no immediate reports of casualties in Mbeketoni, which came while bars and the cafes were packed with fans who were watching the World Cup. At least two hotels were set on fire in the middle of all of that. No one's claimed responsibility for the attack, but an army spokesman blames Al-Shabaab militants from neighboring Somalia. Al-Shabaab has been behind a number of attacks in Kenya, which has sent troops across the border to help Somalia, that is, defeat the Islamic militant group. 4 years ago, the South African government granted amnesty to hundreds of thousands of Zimbabweans who had fled to that country seeking asylum from political violence at home. But now the Pretoria government is tightening its immigration laws, a move which would make it difficult for many Zimbabweans to remain. Tuso Kamalo has more from Johannesburg.
The turmoil in Zimbabwe over the years has forced huge numbers of Zimbabweans, like these women selling items on Johannesburg streets, to flee into neighboring South Africa. Some officials estimate that 2 million Zimbabweans now live in the country. But life here has not been easy. Those who fled political violence have to line up for days, sometimes even at night, to apply for asylum. Many of these immigrants say tough new immigration laws have made their lives difficult. Under the new laws announced in May, some 300,000 Zimbabweans who were given amnesty permits are now required to return home to extend their visa. Zimbabwean immigrant Dorcas Mero, who is now bedridden after a serious road accident, says the new law has brought her life to a standstill.
I'm worried and I'm afraid as well. If they deport me in this situation, I'm afraid.
Her husband, Gift Niza, who was injured in the same accident, is in a similar predicament.
I'm very bitter about these new laws, and I think the new Minister of Home Affairs have to revisit and engage the people and ask the people about their problems.
Bishop Paul Verin of the Central Methodist Church in Johannesburg compares the new immigration laws to those from South Africa's discriminatory past.
It feels as if we're dealing with the same kind of complications as we dealt with the past laws in the old apartheid era.
These immigrants say their fate is now in the hands of the South African government. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
The landing on
and civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
This with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Russian energy giant Gazprom says emergency talks with Ukraine aimed at ending a natural gas pricing dispute have ended without agreement. Company says a deadline of 6 hours universal time today still stands for Ukraine to pay a nearly $2 billion gas debt. Russia and Ukraine have been embroiled in the energy dispute since April, when Moscow nearly doubled the price of gas to Ukraine. Russia has since offered about a 20% discount, but Kiev negotiators there have sought a deeper price cut. Well, as those natural gas talks began, Ukraine on Sunday held a national day of mourning following the death Saturday of 49 servicemen killed when pro-Russian separatists shot down a military plane over the volatile eastern part of the country. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Kiev.
Two strong emotions have washed over Ukraine's capital, sorrow and anger. At midday Sunday, the nation observed a minute of silence – in mourning for 49 soldiers who were killed Saturday when pro-Russian fighters shot down a Ukrainian military transport plane. Throngs of worshippers prayed earnestly at a church in central Kiev that offered refuge and medical facilities to protesters during protests earlier this year that unseated the pro-Russian president. Outside, a blue-eyed young soldier who gave his name only as Private Nikolai said he empathized with the families who lost their loved ones. He says as a soldier, he knows what it is like when a mother loses her son, what commanders and others feel protecting their country, their Ukraine, their children. He says soldiers are carrying out the oath they gave to protect the interests of Ukraine and are fulfilling their duty. A grandmother from northern Ukraine, Zinaida, said she spent more than a decade living in Russia. She says even now, during war, Ukrainians do not hate the Russian people and have no desire to kill. She says the leaders of the two countries are responsible for lots of things. She added that she cannot understand why the two countries, with so much in common, are fighting, and urges reconciliation. But others expressed darker emotions. On Saturday, 300 protesters crowded the Russian embassy in Kiev, hurling epithets at Russia. The former Soviet nations are struggling to hold peace talks after pro-Russian separatists began a military campaign in the Russian-speaking East. The two nations are also on the brink of a breakdown in talks over Russia's role in supplying natural gas to Ukraine, which Moscow has threatened to cut off as soon as Monday. On the streets of Kiev, retired geologist Vasily Mikhailovich had no kind words for the Russian leader. He says he hates Russian President Vladimir Putin and calls him an inhuman monster. He calls the situation a nightmare and a disaster that means some kind of doom on Ukraine. Words like that appear to have become increasingly common in the cosmopolitan Ukrainian capital, filled with Baroque architecture and chic sidewalk cafes, yet where Russian is the most common spoken language. Kievites say they applaud new President Petro Poroshenko's goal to join his nation with the European Union. But Poroshenko has more urgent matters before him with the ongoing violence. In Kiev's independent square, the Maidan, hardcore Ukrainian nationalists in dirty, mismatched camouflage stood next to striking, fashion-conscious women. Together, they yelled phrases like, "Glory to Ukraine." At the rain-soaked protests, leaders urged Ukrainians to fight for their sovereignty. This protest leader says they want an independent Ukraine, a sovereign, democratic country. A nearby blue and yellow flag fluttered at half-staff, contributing to the mix of grief and defiance. As Russia and Ukraine face off, the question is, which emotion is going to win? Anita Powell, VOA News, Kiev.
Latest scores from the World Cup in Brazil. In Sunday action, Switzerland beat Ecuador 2-1. That happened in Group E. Also in Group E, France took Honduras 3-0. And Group F, Argentina defeated Bosnia-Herzegovina 2-1. And turning to later today, Iran takes on Nigeria in Group F. Also, Germany and Portugal will hit the pitch. They're in Group G, and Ghana will take on the U.S., also in Group G. Well, the city where Pelé rose to fame honored its favorite son on Sunday, celebrating the life and career of the Brazilian football great. Hundreds of dignitaries were on hand in the port city of Santos to toast the 73-year-old Pelé and to open the Pelé Museum. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. And a reminder, you can find us on the Internet anytime at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday. We'll be right back.
This is Today in History. On June 16, 1816, the famous English poet Lord Byron is believed to have read the book Phantasmagoriana to four house guests in Switzerland. The reading led him to challenge his guests, Percy Shelley, Mary Shelley, Claire Claremont, and John Polidori, to write their own ghost stories. As a result, Mary Shelley wrote the novel Frankenstein, John Polidori wrote a short story called The Vampire, and Byron wrote the poem Darkness, all horror classics. In 1858, Abraham Lincoln accepted the Illinois Republican Party's nomination for a seat in the U.S. Senate, warning that tensions over the issue of slavery threatened to split the nation. That split did, in fact, occur 2 years later when Lincoln, having lost his bid to become a senator, was elected president of the United States. Pro-slavery states immediately began to leave the Union, and soon the nation was in a full-blown civil war. In 1903, the Ford Motor Company, founded by U.S. industrialist Henry Ford, was incorporated. In 1940, Marshal Henri-Philippe Pétain became the prime minister of the Vichy government of Nazi-occupied France during World War II. Pétain was convicted of treason after the war. His death sentence was commuted to life in prison. In 1947, Dumont broadcast the first television network newscast. It was called News from Washington. In 1958, former Hungarian premier Imre Nagy was executed for treason by his country's communist authorities. A proponent of liberal reforms, Nagy became a symbol of resistance to Soviet interference in Hungarian affairs. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Promoting democracy worldwide remains a key U.S. priority, not only because democracy promotes fundamental values such as respect for human rights, but also because democratic governments promote more stable, inclusive societies and create the best conditions for prosperity. In democratic societies, voters hold governments accountable for their well-being. As a result, genuinely democratic governments encourage participation from all sectors of society, enable the formation of capable, reliable, and transparent institutions, ensure the rule of law, independent judiciaries, free presses, and strong civil society and private sectors. These institutions, in turn, protect democracy from those who might seek to weaken or trample upon it and create the conditions for broad-based economic growth and development. And this is largely what we've observed in most of the Western Hemisphere since the turn of the millennium. The last decade has been a story of democracy and economic achievement in Latin America and the Caribbean, writes Secretary of State John Kerry in a recent opinion column. This transformation didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen by accident. Rising prosperity was produced by sustained efforts to open and integrate markets, encourage innovation, and recognize that a society achieves real prosperity and economic stability by embracing inclusiveness. As a result, the region's economies grew at a rate of 4% a year and lifted more than 73 million people out of poverty. Nonetheless, the job is not finished yet, wrote Secretary Kerry. The path we need to follow is crystal clear. Leaders across the hemisphere need to set aside racial differences in favor of inclusiveness, advocate for the rights of women, and recognize that sexual orientation is a private matter. They must build on economic progress by opening markets to free trade and expanding opportunities for young people eager to enter the workforce. The United States offers its support to regional initiatives like the Inter-American Social Protection Network to promote best practices on social protection through direct investment, such as our multi-year program with Colombia to improve access to justice and combat human rights violations in areas recovering from conflict, and through programs like the 100,000 Strong in the Americas Student Exchange Initiative. Accountable, democratic governance is the surest way to expand social and economic opportunities and attain inclusive development. The United States is committed to working with our partners to achieve these goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.